Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Top Cow Thursday episode. And yesterday, as you listen to this, April 25th, we had the second issue of Cyberforce come out. And we're lucky enough to be joined by one of the writers of that title, Brian Edward Hill. Been on the show before, but welcome back, Brian.
Hey, how are you guys doing? Thanks for having me on again.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. I've said on Twitter before, and for you listeners that maybe don't follow me on Twitter, not only is Brian one of my favorite writers, he's one of my favorite people. He's always so fun and approachable at shows, so I encourage you, if you're ever at a convention where Brian is, he loves talking comics and talking stories, so go up there and say hi. Definitely follow him on social media, because in addition to being a great writer and a great guy, he is a voice of reason in a sea of madness that is Twitter.
Twitter can get really dark really fast, so I do the best I can to try to keep a positive vibe, at least on my timeline and my interactions, just to kind of just tone down the conflict a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So, Brian, for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with you, let's talk first about your history with comics. Did you grow up reading them? How did that whole thing start?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I had trouble reading in general. Like, reading comprehension was kind of difficult for me, and I used to stutter too. So I just had some issues around like communication. But comic books were some of the things that helped me get comfortable with words and speech and all of that. So they were originally given to me to kind of help me find reading material that I could absorb rather easily, because I would find a book sort of intimidating. My mother worked tirelessly to make sure that I wouldn't be intimidated by reading and writing. And part of that was comics. And so, I read the format a lot when I was a kid. And then when I was about 7 years old, my dad died. It was cancer. It was, nothing violent happened. But I remember the day it happened, the day I found out about it, my mother took me to a comic book store, because it was always like a fun place to be, right. And you'd go there and see the superhero standees and you'd get really happy and all of that. And so it was just kind of a comfortable place. And when I was there, I read an issue of Batman. I picked it up. I don't even remember what number it was. The cover was little Bruce Wayne in the alleyway holding both of his parents' hands after, they were shot down by Joe Chill. And I just identified with Bruce. I got it. You're going through one of these terrible experiences. You're getting a lot of wisdom from the adults around you, but none of it's really resonating. You're hearing things like, you're the man of the house now, and you have to do these things now, and you just can't put that into your mind as a kid. But when I read that issue, I recognized, well, Bruce was going through the same thing that I'm going through, and he was able to turn it into something. And that helped me, that helped me kind of reframe tragedy in a specific way. So after that, I became a rabid fan of Batman. And collected pretty much all the monthlies, Batman, Detective, Shadow of the Bat, Legends of the Dark Knight. And it was primarily my collecting was in the Batverse, but I also read Captain America a lot. I just loved Captain America. I just thought he was awesome in the whole Nomad period and all that, and read some action comics. So yeah, I have quite a few long boxes of books that are bagged and boarded in my family home in St. Louis, Missouri. So comics have been, with me for quite some time. And then when I got a little older and I was more comfortable with reading and writing and I was getting into literature and considering the idea of being a storyteller, that was about the time when Grant Morrison's Arkham Asylum hit and Frank Miller's work hit, and Alan Moore's Watchmen and that sort of stuff. And the literary comic books that were still like steeped in the superhero mythos and superhero culture, but they had the same resonance and depth that, To Kill a Mockingbird had, that Hemingway had. So I was able to kind of grow up and just find new books that would match where my mind was at the time. So it, kept the love going for a very long time.
And as you kind of started to think about developing your career and becoming a storyteller and a writer and such, were comics always a part of it, or did you drift away for a while and come back?
I honestly never considered being a comic book writer. mainly because I didn't know how one became a comic book writer. You know, there wasn't any sort of pathway. I saw how people would learn how to draw comics. I mean, there was the Kubert School and all of that. And, you know, you take illustration classes in high school and that sort of thing. But comics just seemed impenetrable as a creator. So I focused on filmmaking. I'm a big cinema head. I love movies. So I said, well, you know, I like telling stories a lot. And at the time, I was interested in being a filmmaker because the stories I was reading in comics weren't being reflected in a lot of the films. Right. I mean, I loved the 89 Tim Burton Batman. You know, that was a formative cinematic experience for me. I saw that movie about 3-4 times that summer. I still have the ticket stubs.
Wow.
From the opening day. Yeah. June 23rd, 1989, 7:30 p.m. So that movie was a huge influence. But a lot of the movies from that era, late 80s, early 90s, didn't quite hit the mark. You know, I'm reading this stuff in comics that's brilliant and interesting and grounded, but also fantastic and challenging in a lot of levels and also incredibly visceral. And then I would look at the movies, and the movies were just a little empty compared to the books. You know, it pretty much just had like the Burton Batman in 89, then The Crow, I think, in like 92, I want to say. I think those movies were pretty good about, kind of matching the force of their source material. So I set my mind to being a filmmaker that would help translate the work that I love to the screen. And that got me really interested in being a filmmaker. So I went to NYU and did that whole thing. Now, you know, it's different. Now you get great comic book movies, you know, every 2 days or so. But, my love of cinema is kind of what took over my education, really. And then when I came out of school, I lived with a comic book artist, a guy named Nelson Blake. He was my roommate for a while. He actually gave me a couch to sleep on. Nelson is the illustrator of my first original Image comic book, Romulus. There's a trade paperback out in stores everywhere. I think it's on Amazon too. So Nelson gave me a couch to sleep on in New York after school. And I kind of hung out with a bunch of comic book guys. And that's how I reignited the idea of being a comic book creator, because now I had met artists and I met some writers, and it was a little less spooky how one would get a job in the industry. But it still took me years. I had a film produced before I wrote my first comic book.
Yeah, I think people don't realize how small of an industry it is and how rare it really is to write comics. Matt Hawkins, you know, over there at Top Cow, says all the time, there are more NFL professional football players, there are more players in the NFL than there are comic writers. And you know, people think of NFL players as this elite upper echelon, like pinnacle to reach. There are more people that play in the right. NFL than there are comic writers. And I think that when people hear that, they're really blown away by it. They just don't realize how tough and how small the industry really is.
Yeah, it really is a small industry. And I don't want anyone who's listening to this to be discouraged. It doesn't mean that you can't get a job, that you can't become a comic book writer. You certainly can. You just have to allow yourself some patience. And for people on the outside, who are buying books and following heroes and the rest of it, it can seem like someone suddenly just shows up and now they're writing 4 or 5 books for major comic book companies. And I realize it looks like that. But the reason it looks like that is you probably haven't seen the 5, 6, 8, 10 years of independent work they were doing before they got those opportunities. They probably only got to your radar when they were working big two, or even, you know, big two, medium five, right? Because a lot of the local stores, they don't carry all of the independent work. So you may never have heard of it, but people in the industry are familiar with that small market book that so-and-so did and this other thing that so-and-so does. And so they'll get a lot of work in a relatively short amount of time, and it'll seem like it all happens overnight. And conversely, if it doesn't happen for a person overnight, they'll start to blame themselves and internalize that and say, well, maybe I'm not cut out for this. And it's just not the case. You have to be prepared for some adversity. You have to be prepared for some rejection. And what's worse than rejection is, you know, being ignored, really, right? Like, that's the thing. You know, like, sometimes you'll send submissions and they won't get back to you and you won't even know if they read it or not. And it can be really disheartening, but everyone goes through that. It takes a long time, usually, for someone to find a foothold in the business. So if you're toiling away and you're climbing up that mountain, just keep climbing. You'll get there.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories out there of 10-year overnight successes, right?
You just absolutely.
And the other thing that's funny, and I've heard many, many creators say this, is that yes, comics are hard to break into, but it is possible. But the other thing is that no two people have the exact same story of how they break in. And it's almost like once you break in a certain way, comics has a way of like closing that off. This person did such and such and such to get in. Oh, we can't allow that. We're glad they're here because they're good, but we'll close off that avenue. And then you kind of have to find your own, a different way, a different tunnel in. I've heard so many people tell that story, and I love hearing the way people break in because they're all very unique. And I think it says a lot about the creators. And some of them have very creative ways, some of them more traditional, but you know, everybody has their own story to tell in that way.
And I would add to that if there is one thing that I do believe can yield a positive result, it's writing a script, you know, or four scripts, or, you know, whatever your story is, writing a story out, saving up some money, hiring a decent artist to draw that story. Maybe the same artist can color it, maybe not. Maybe you have, you know, pencils to colors, or maybe you have pencils, inks, and colors, whatever it is. Just set aside a budget. If you have to, you know, put away some work money to do it, or even take like a little part-time job to make some money to do it, set aside some money, pay an artist to execute your story, pay a letterer, a good letterer, to execute the letters, and just put it online and share it online. And people will read it. If it looks professional and you've hired good people, people will take a look at it, and it'll spread, and it'll get out there, and it'll be a decent calling card for your work. Like, you know, like any creative industry, you have to invest into your own business. If you're a filmmaker, you know, if you're a novelist, even, all of it takes investment. So if you make that commitment to wanting to walk the path, I would tell you, yeah, just write your script, hire an artist, get it drawn, and just put it out there, and then tweet about it, you know, and contact people online and find, you know, build yourself a press kit, and then send your press kit out to people, because there are a million websites. They need to cover something every day. You know, they all need content. And if you make it easy for them to regard your story, they'll probably talk about it, and you'd be surprised at how much momentum you can build from simply sharing a piece of work with people directly, with readers, rather than keeping everything under the vest until you can submit it to people and letting things live and die solely in someone's email.
Yeah, it's 100% true. And I would add to that, be professional, be nice. You know, like we said, it is a small industry. So, you know, it's interesting being a comic writer, is that everybody pulls for everybody else. You know, Jason Inman was on the show recently talking about Jupiter Jet that he did at Action Labs. And, you know, there are a very finite number of jobs for comic book writers. We just talked about that. And so in a way, you would almost think that people would get competitive and cutthroat. But that's not how it is. It's so nice of an industry that even though they're your competition, you still root for other writers to do well. You know, rising tide floats all ships. Everybody wants the industry to do well, and we all want to see great stories. I think most comic writers, the overwhelming majority of them, are fans of the medium as well. They want to read good stories too. So when somebody catches lightning in a bottle, yeah, they want to promote it. So yeah, be nice.
Absolutely. I remember when I was the first New York con that I went to, I don't know if it was the first one, but it was like the first one that I went to. And I was a nobody. I mean, I was so much of a nobody. This was like the poorest year I had in New York. So a friend of mine had an office building in Midtown. I was living in the office building, sleeping in an empty office. You know, he had this whole floor. So I was sleeping in an empty office. I was taking quote unquote showers in the office bathroom. Right. This is how poor I was. And the New York con was happening. Nelson was going to go to it. So I went with Nelson to it. And it was a pretty small event at the time. It hadn't gotten really huge in Hollywood yet. It was still pretty just, you know, comic fans and comic creators for comic fans. And I bumped into Brian Azzarello. He had a table there, and he had some books there. I think he had 100 Bullets, and he might have Loveless out at the time, which I'm a big fan of. I love Loveless. I love that book. And I talked to Brian, you know, just kind of like a fan, really. I was just a huge fan of his work. His work was a big influence on me. And we spoke a little bit about technique. And he talked to me for about 45, 50 minutes, you know, just like, hey, this is the kind of way I do it. And, These are the things that help me out. And he was enormously generous and helpful for me. You know, the equivalent in some other industry would be like, suddenly Martin Scorsese would talk to you for an hour about filmmaking, yeah. You know, or like Christopher Nolan would say, hey, let me tell you about why I choose the lenses I choose and my editing technique, right? You know, like Drake talking to you about producing hip hop or something. You know, comics is the one industry where luminaries, if they have the time, will be incredibly open to having good conversations. If you're polite and respectful, obviously, don't come up there with like a camera to make a point on YouTube. But like, you know, if you're really genuinely interested in someone's work, you know, it's a place where you can get that information. You can have those experiences that teach you, yeah, you know what, I am on the right path. It's hard now, but it won't be hard forever. And this was a good day.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And one more thing to add is that, you know, and I know Mark Silvestri at Top Cow talks about this all the time. Mark Brooks, who's an incredibly talented illustrator over at Marvel, says the same thing. It has never been easier for you as a budding creator to get your stuff out there in front of eyes. You talked about having a hard time breaking into the industry. Go back and talk to the people that broke in before there was the internet, right? I mean, no excuse. You can get your stuff out there on the internet in front of a lot of people's eyes, and with social media, spread the word around a lot easier than they could back then when people were creating fanzines and, you know, making Xerox copies, stapling it together and literally mailing it out in the mail. So no excuses. If you want to be a writer, write. If you want to be an illustrator, work on your craft and get it out there on the internet. It's you know, a lot easier now than it ever has been.
What I always tell people is, if you have the time to share your lunch and your new haircut, you have the time to share your work.
100%. 100%. Let's talk a little bit about some of your work, Brian. We're going to talk about Cyberforce in a minute here. But for those listeners who aren't familiar, you've kind of started to get a pretty good body of work going. You want to let us know what you currently have on the stands these days?
Yeah. So currently I'm relaunching Cyberforce. The second issue is, you know, I think out.
Yeah.
Was it out this week? I believe it's out this
week. Out this week. Yeah. As of the release of this, it would have come out yesterday, the 25th.
Excellent. Excellent. And I've been working on Michael Cray for DC Comics, which is a spinoff of the Wildstorm, sort of overseen by Warren Ellis. I think we are in our eighth issue release. No, seven. I think seven is coming out.
Yeah,
if not
sounds,
this week, then I think next
right.
week.
Yep.
So that's there. I think Postal just wrapped up, but I did a long, like two, three odd years on that book. And I've got a couple other things I can't quite announce yet. It's a new original series that I'm doing that will be announced soon and pretty high profile, so look out for that. And then I have a Hong Kong Fooey Black Lightning one-shot team-up crossover thing, Hanna-Barbera DC deal. That is, I think it's been in previews already, but look for that over the next couple months. And then I'm also doing Detective Comics for at least Snark starting in June. I believe issue 983 will be my issue. So I'm doing at least five issues of that, and it may lead to something pretty interesting, but I can't tell you what.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so obviously we can't talk about everything. I mean, I could keep you on the podcast for 8 hours, but I know you have work to do. So I'll touch on Michael Cray really quick. Love the story. Love what's going on. Love the idea of, for those of you not reading it, Michael Cray, or Deathblow, as many will recognize him by that name from the original Wildstorm universe. In this new Warren Ellis kind of reimagined universe, he goes by, you know, his given name of Michael Cray, and he's almost like a fixer in a way.
Yeah.
And he's
Essentially, you know, Michael is an assassin who worked for the government for a while, then he worked for the Black Ops government for a while, and then they betrayed him. So now he's working for a woman named Christine Trelane, who has her own little kind of black ops off the book outfit. And Christine is concerned about these eccentric and powerful people around the world who might be doing some nefarious things. And these people in the world of the Wildstorm happen to be the superheroes we know and love. So the book is really about Michael Cray being assigned to hunt down and kill dark, corrupt versions of Green Arrow, The Flash, you know, etc. And now we are in the second half, it was always going to be a 12-issue run. So in the second half of this run, and things are going to start getting really interesting and really weird, because I'm bringing my own version of John Constantine into the mix. Definitely check it out. Like, I brought up the idea up to Warren because, you know, Kray, being an assassin, is a grounded guy. He's a military guy. He's tactile. He believes in things that are made, that he can fix, that he can control. And I felt like, well, the best character to throw into his world would be someone who comes from the esoteric. You know, I want to see the magician versus the marine. You know, like, that's the thing that I want to see. I want to see how these two men interact. And in addition to Constantine and Kray having their interactions, we've also got an evil Wonder Woman in the mix.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's this whole, I mean, it's really gods and monsters, right? Like, that's kind of what the second half of the Kray story is. And I'm really excited about the work that's coming through. I think I'm starting to find my rhythm with that character, you know, and how those stories should be told. And I think the work gets better every issue.
Yeah, we got a tease of that in issue 6 when Michael Kray goes up against Aquaman. And yeah, it's a great book. I really recommend it. It's cool that you're getting to work on these kind of alternate versions of heroes, and kind of we're seeing the flip side of that. Like, what if it had gone a different way and they ended up on the other side of the justice, so to speak? So it's been a really great book. So I want to give you kudos on that.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
Let's go ahead and talk about Cyberforce. So obviously this mm-hmm. is the book that Mark Silvestri launched Top Cow with. So it's been around, you know, a long time, 20 years. And you guys are kind of taking the same kind of overall theme of the book. So for those of our listeners who've maybe never read Cyberforce, what's kind of the overall story of Cyberforce, so to speak?
Well, Cyberforce, put simply, is about a corporation, an entity called CyberData, that has enhanced a group of people with abilities based on transhumanism, you know, the kind of the melding of technology and humanity, really. And so the Cyber Force, as it were, are the products of these experiments, and they're tasked with trying to keep the world from tearing itself apart. But they also don't know if they can trust the people they work for. You know, Cyberforce was the first thing that I ever wanted to write at Top Cow. The first pitch that I ever gave Matt Hawkins was a Cyberforce pitch, because I'm just a huge fan of science fiction action. Like, James Cameron movies were, you know, my thing growing up. You know, I've seen them like countless times. And I know the moment that Matt was like, hey, yeah, send me a pitch, I sent him this pitch. It was kind of a globe-trotting, Ghost in the Shell-like exploration of the character Aphrodite. And it had shades of Metal Gear and other things in it. And he read it and liked the pitch, but there were a lot of reasons why he couldn't do it. It wasn't the right time for some Cyberforce stuff and the whole deal, but he remembered it. So when Matt and Mark got together, and this is after I've been writing Postal for a long time and Golgotha and other things, been working on at Top Cow. When Matt and Mark got together and thought about relaunching Cyberforce, they came to me and said, hey, Brian, would you like to be involved in this? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know, because Cyberforce was one of those things that, you know, I was just a huge fan of and felt like there was a lot of potential. And it felt like a good time to reapproach and sort of redefine what those characters mean now. Now, anytime you're writing stories about characters that are connected and defined by technology, you have to kind of adjust them, you know, for the periods and the cycles that we have. And so when Cyberforce was created, transhumanism was a far-off concept. You know, the idea that you would blend, you know, robot parts with human parts. I mean, we had, like, rudimentary prosthetic limbs and things like that. But we were really just talking about clamps with, you know, some kind of like electrode activated close and open functions. Now we are on the verge of a Metal Gear like world. You know, we're developing, not only are we developing sort of physical cybernetics, very close to the kinds of things that Cameron was warning us about, we're also developing artificial intelligence, which is even closer to the kind of things that Cameron was warning about. So, now, I think, is a good time to re-explore those characters and think about, you know, what it would mean now and what a team like that would be now. And not so much thinking about them as transformed to something different than humanity, but perhaps, you know, augmentation is the future of humanity. And maybe they're the clarion call that begins our technological evolution. And so those questions, I think, are interesting and worth exploring. And then, frankly, I wanted to blow a lot of stuff up. And Cyberforce is a great book to blow a lot of stuff up. So it was the exact thing. You know, after working so long in Postal, and for listeners who don't know, Postal is this kind of intimate small town crime narrative that I'm very proud of. The work there, I think, is solid work. And I've gotten a lot of great responses from readers from it. But sorry about the plane passing in the background. But I really wanted to do something that was big. I wanted big action. I wanted splash pages and technology. And so the Cyberforce call came at the right time. And here we are.
And those ideas of transhumanism and kind of pushing the boundaries of what is man, what is machine, are those the ideas that really attract you to Cyberforce, along with the blowing stuff up?
They do. And the emotional consequence of that stuff, you know, like in the first issue, we focus on Morgan Stryker, who's like the protagonist, I suppose, of the group, and his daughter, you know, Karen, who will eventually become Velocity. And I spoke to Matt and Mark, and I told them, as much as I wanted to explore Morgan's transformation from soldier to super soldier, I wanted to explore the idea of Karen being wheelchair bound when we first see her. And then through technology, she's able to walk, and not only walk, she's able to run and move with the kind of speed that a by birth Olympic athlete wouldn't be able to do, and what that felt like. And I wanted the relationship between Morgan and Karen, between father and daughter. You know, on his end, he has this power. He's wary of it. He doesn't necessarily want to define himself by it. So he's always sort of limiting how much of it he considers part of him, really. He's coming to terms with it. With Karen, I wanted to have a character that didn't really feel like she was alive until she had that higher functionality. And now she does. So between the two characters, you have this like yin and yang relationship to augmentation, really. And I think there's a parable there that's applicable for our real lives. You know, we're coming into a time where pretty soon, within a generation, we might be able to make genetic decisions about our offspring the moment, you know, we conceive them. And what does that mean, really? You know, what does that mean for advantage in the world? If you can pay $5 million and be guaranteed that your child will be disease-free, that your child will have a high IQ, that, you know, you can lay dormant to some of the things in their genetic code that might cause them difficulties, well, what happens to the world that can't afford it?
You know, we're talking about being able to basically manipulate things and extend lifespans and, you know, augment our bodies, our physical bodies. And we're getting so close to that, you know, we're, like you said, we're on the cusp of it. So really exploring this idea of what makes us human and when does the man stop and the machine or the augmentation, like how far can you go, right? Like how much augmentation can you have? What's the line where you become more machine than man? Right. I mean, that's really,
that's
more relevant.
That's the thing
now,
that
right?
I think is that's what fascinates me the most about cybernetics and artificial intelligence and the rest of it. To be honest, I'm not that interested in stories about whether or not robots have souls, whether or not they're real. I mean, and that's mainly because my perspective is if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then I treat it like a duck. Right. So I'm very certain about where I stand on all of that. In a world of Blade Runner replicants, I treat them like people because they act like people.
Yep.
You know, in Westworld, I think they should be free because they want to be free. So those ideas for me have kind of been settled on. But what's the frightening and strange territory for just me as a thinker is what will humanity become And how do we prevent ourselves from creating a society where you can literally purchase longevity, purchase intelligence, purchase, you know, physical resilience? And you can do a measure of that now. Like, for instance, one of the things people don't consider is that education itself is a form of technology. You know, like methods of education, that's technology. When I was a kid, I went to a Montessori school in my grade school time. And it's a very tactile school. They keep very small classrooms. And that was my first through sixth grade experience. And that helped build a relationship between me and learning. And then when you go to a high school, and the high school has its own library, and it's a good library, and then you've got, you know, you're learning the operating systems of the latest computers because you have a good computer lab. You know, when you're studying chemistry and you're doing all of this stuff, and, you know, when you're even in English and history class and you're being taught things with interesting techniques of education, that is all technology. So in a way, we've already started the path of creating a society where certain people will just have greater advantage because of their access to tech. It's more of an amorphous thing now, but it's going to become a quite literal thing if we continue to march into the future. Because the fact is, you know, people will always do what they have to give their children the best lives, by and large. I mean, there are bad parents out there, but by and large, people will always do what's in the best interest of their children. And when you have economic disparity like we have right now, and you have a class of very wealthy people, the moment that they get access to technology that will allow them to give their children a permanent advantage, they're going to use it. And instead of having a world where, you know, we can sort of praise difference for all of its strengths and praise the variety of difference and for what they can do for a society, we might be in a world where objectively we're making stronger, smarter people. And then what happens to sociology? You know, what happens to how our society is broken down? Could we ever have a president that was fully human? Or would we collectively decide, nope, we need the president to be better than human? You know, we need senators to be better than human. You know, we need police officers to be upgraded with this technology. So those are the things that keep me up at night when I think about where we're headed with tech.
Yeah, you could see that disparity between the have and have-nots grow. And on top of that, you want to talk about, you know, sociological implications. What happens when you start having people that live 200 years, 300 years, 400 years? What does that
Absolutely.
Do? What does that do to their emotion and their state of mind? I mean, we simply don't know because it hasn't happened. So, you know,
And we have this idea, we have this emotional idea that the more intelligent a species gets, the more enlightened it gets. But we don't really have a lot of evidence of that in the natural world.
Right.
Right? Like if you were to look at the natural world, we don't really have evidence that more intelligence will equal a more beneficial society. You know, you might wind up with people that are just able to make very cold decisions, you know, based on what is best for the species writ large, but that might include sacrificing a lot of people, right? So those are the ideas that I think are interesting about a world like Cyberforce. And in the first four issues, I'm blowing a lot of stuff up.
Yeah.
Because I want people to get a good high-octane action experience. But I will say that we have a villain in the story, and I'm going to, you know, write some script tonight. We have a villain in the story who's also very concerned about where technology is going to take us. And that villain has a very interesting relationship to technology. And so we're going to explore that a little bit. And I can promise readers that the state of the world at the end of these first four issues is going to result in a lot of fertile ground for a lot of stories.
Yeah, and I think that we'd be remiss if we didn't mention your artist on the series, because he's the one who is really showing us these epic events. He's showing us the way you're blowing things up, and that's Atillo Rojo. And right. I have to give kudos to him for kind of the grand scale. He does make it feel big. He does make it feel, for lack of a better term, cinematic. But at the same time, a lot of emotion in the face, especially with Morgan Stryker. We can feel the emotion and the doubt that you yourself mentioned about whether or not this is a good thing for him and for, you know, his daughter. And so, it's a rare artist that can kind of equally do both well. And, I think Rojo does that, exceptionally well.
Well, yeah, I worked with Attilio, on a book called Eden's Fall that was connected to Postal, a book that I was writing, based on one of Matt's ideas. I mean, Matt's like the godfather of this whole Postal, think tank, the Tithe universe, these crime books, basically. So, you know, he handed Postal to me for a while, and I've been, you know, kind of writing it ever since, but he wanted to do a crossover that brought these characters together. And that's when I first worked with Attilio Rojo. And when the art came back, it was just so visceral. You know, it just felt, so not real, but like intense in a way that not a lot of artists, I think, you know, can render as well as he can. So when, you know, we talked about Cyberforce and we talked about Attilio, I'm like, well, let me lean into that with these first four, because I know he can handle that stuff really well. And whenever I write a splash page or a big panel or a big moment and I get the art back, it's always amazing.
Yeah, his art is incredible. Well, let's go ahead and switch gears. I know there's a subsection of our audience out there that tuned in probably specifically to hear you talk about your dream gig. You're finally going to be writing Batman, Detective Comics, and what else is really, really awesome. I mentioned Mark Brooks' name earlier. Mark's a friend, an incredible artist. So he's going to be doing variant covers. I mean, he's done the majority of his professional work over at Marvel. Probably 98% of his work has been at Marvel. But he's going to be doing the variant covers for your – I think his first one is 983, which I think is going to be your first issue on the book. So that has me like super excited. I can't wait. So Detective Comics, dream gig. How did this whole thing come about? Had you been bugging Dan Didio ever since you got a foot in the door over there at DC? Like, let me write Batman. He finally gave in.
No, honestly, not really. I mean, you know, look, like Batman is like the Hamlet of comics, right? Like, so if you're an actor, you know, you have to jump through that Hamlet hoop at some point,
right?
You know, just to sort of, you know, flex your artistic muscle. But look who's writing Batman. You've got James Tynion in the fourth, Scott Snyder, Tom King. Like, you know, you're not a guy like me thinking, yeah, I think it's time for me to be in a group of guys like that. Right? Like, that's just, you know, that's just not realistic. So I had no designs on writing Bruce Wayne at all. You know, I mean, I have a lot of opinions about the character and I love the character. He means a great deal to me, as I'm sure he means to, you know, countless people around the world. But it honestly wasn't something that I was giving a lot of thought to. Now, I think when I started working on the Titans television show that will premiere later on this year, and for listeners who don't know that, yeah, I'm one of the writers on the Titans TV show. I also write TV. And I got to talk to Geoff Johns about Robin, because Robin is a character in that show. It did start to wake up an informed desire to maybe play around in Gotham for a little bit. But even then, I never really considered, you know, doing that. So the email that I got kind of came out of the blue. You know, it was like I was in Canada. I was producing an episode of TV. You know, one of my episodes shot back to back. So I was actually in Toronto for about 6 weeks. And I get this email from DC Comics, and it's Chris Conroy, the editor over there. And he's like, hey, Brian, would you be interested in writing an arc of Detective Comics? We want to do like a Black Lightning Batman crossover, but beyond that, you know, we're open to whatever ideas you have. And I was like, okay, sure. So I sent over some ideas, and I asked them if they could loop Scott into the conversation, because I wanted to make sure that whatever I was thinking was in line with kind of Scott's design in the universe, because I think that Scott had kind of created the sort of modern day Batman and comics that we have that everyone else is sort of working inside of. And Tom King's doing some great work, James doing some great work, but I have to trace all that back to Scott and what Scott did with the book. So I wanted to make sure that my ideas were something that Scott, you know, liked and thought were good directions and all of that. And he responded very positively to what I had to say. And that kind of started the whole process. But no, I never really, you know, I met Dan like a year ago, but I met him recently when I was doing the Hong Kong Fooey Black Lightning crossover book. And, you know, Dan's a great guy. We're just having a hoot about old Kung Fu movies and Big Trouble in Little China and all that stuff. But yeah, I never brought up Batman. I just don't think you can do that. You know, it's like, you don't want to sit in front of a guy like Dan DiDio or Jim Lee or Jamie Ridge or Scott Snyder and say, hey, I want to write Batman. I think you just sound silly. So, I just sat there, but certainly when the opportunity showed up, I was more than happy to jump in and get into deep in the pool as soon as I could.
Yeah, you tell them, I want to write Batman, and they're like, yeah, you and everybody else, buddy, get in line.
Yeah, like, you know, like when you talk about a small group, you know, comic book writers, well, people who have written Batman, that's an even smaller group, right? That's a very small circle in the Venn diagram. And to be honest, I don't really think I deserve that opportunity, so I'm doing the best I can to make sure that what I do is up to the standard.
Don't sell yourself short, Brian. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that it's been a small group, but yet decades and decades of history of Batman. So what are you doing to try to make it unique and trying to put your, you know, your own spin on the character? How do you think that it's going to stand out?
Well, you know, when you're in a situation, when you're writing an established character that also exists in a lot of other books, I think it's a little silly to echo what's being done simultaneously, right? Like, you sort of want to create unique experiences. And so Tom is doing a brilliant job of deep diving into Bruce Wayne's sort of emotional state, into the idea of what Bruce wants. You know, can Bruce be happy? Like, all of these ideas. It's a very kind of intimate story that Tom is telling, you know, right now. And then James, you know, he's ending his run with a deep dive exploration of Robin and what the legacy of Batman means for each other and for Gotham City as well as, you know, Bruce Wayne. So what I wanted to do was create a kind of classic detective comics experience. You know, I wanted to bring a villain into the scenario that's going to test Bruce and everyone who works with him. And if we're bringing Black Lightning into this, I wanted that villain to also test, you know, kind of Black Lightning. So I think what readers will get out of my arc, hopefully, is something that feels maybe even a little more Chris Nolan than the other titles. You know, it's definitely a lot. It's intense. And I think we have a new villain who is really interesting to me, who's testing a side of Batman in a way that we haven't really seen recently. So, you know, that was sort of my approach. I'm a villain guy. You know, I think that in order to have a great story, you have to have a great villain. And to define a hero, you need to see that hero kind of face and suffer and be thrown into a crucible of sorts. It's just the way my mind works. So whenever someone is like, hey, would you like to write this character? The first thing that comes to mind is, okay, who's going to be the antagonist? You know, what's an interesting way to test this character? You know, how can I do that? And that's the approach I'm taking here. So readers can expect something that's pretty intense. There's a lot of action in there. I get to write a little Cassandra Cain, and I'm really excited about that because I'm a huge fan of Cassandra Cain. And we're going to explore the idea of legacy and what Bruce has done to the people that work with him, especially as he wants to bring someone like Black Lightning into his scenario. And then from the Black Lightning end, I really wanted to approach that character as someone who's figuring themselves out in the DC universe, like who they are. You know, he doesn't come from a mystical island of warriors. He doesn't come from a far advanced planet, you know, landing on this one with the sun giving him powers. He isn't a billionaire. You know, he doesn't have that. He's a man, he's a teacher, Jefferson Pierce, who's trying to make the world better. But he's at a point in his life where I think he has to decide, am I headed towards being a Justice League guy? Or am I not, you know, set on that path? And I think Bruce sees great potential in Jefferson because he is both teacher and hero. And so what Bruce would like to do is integrate both of those things within Jefferson's kind of mind and his approach. And so that's the character story between those two men.
Yeah, let's open it up to a question from Twitter. Brian had posted on Twitter that he was coming on the show, and we had a few questions. And this kind of – you've sort of answered this already, but I think there's still something here. So Idle Red Hands on Twitter asks, other than great stories, how would you most like to add to the Batman legacy? New Batmobile? Question mark. New addition to the Rogues Gallery? Question mark. And feel free to bring back the KGB Beast, rather. So I think you mentioned that we're going to see a new villain. I think that would be awesome if – that villain actually becomes a member of the Rogues Gallery. But what can you say about adding to the Batman legacy and the possibility of a new Batmobile?
Well, as far as Batmobiles go, I don't have much of a problem with the current Batmobile. So I don't think I'll be redesigning that machine, at least within these five issues.
Sorry, Idle.
Apologies. Sorry, Idle. KGB Beast is awesome. And were I to be able to continue, you know, writing Batman stories, I'm sure you would see him show up at some point. And then as far as the Rogues Gallery goes, well, yeah, you know, Tom is doing such a great job with the villains that we're familiar with, you know, the kind of the classic Batman villains. And the way Tom is doing it, it's almost like each villain represents a part of Bruce Wayne's psyche. And it's just such a well-woven tapestry of a narrative. I didn't see much point in bringing in somebody, you know, from that, because it would just sort of get in the way, I think, of what Tom's doing right now. I can say, and I think it's revealed in the solicitations, that Brainiac will play a part in the story, for sure, in addition to a new villain. And the relationship that Brainiac has with this new villain, I'm really fascinated with, and opens up a lot of story opportunities. You know, as for what, you know, I can sort of bring to the Bat mythos, I mean, I don't know. You know, if everything with Bruce Wayne, I think I understand the desire to do something insane up until the point where it becomes too dangerous to be done. And that's the part of Bruce I'm exploring, right? Like, that's the thing. I mean, his life is barely controlled madness. You know, he's dressing up like a bat and trying to protect the city. He's got, you know, young people also in costume wearing his symbol, working with him, for him, continuing his legacy. You know, he's trying to keep all of these volatile personalities kind of on his very disciplined, straight and narrow path, while making sure that his own life doesn't trip over into pure insanity. So that aspect of Bruce is something I'm really looking forward to explore, and I think readers will probably enjoy what I've got to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, just hearing you talk about it, I'm like, okay, I'm ready for this book right now. All right, we do have one other question from Twitter. Lyle Klo, sure, if I'm pronouncing that right, asks, maybe you get asked this a lot, but when a writer takes over a book like Detective, for example, one with a lot of history, what kind of prep is provided and expected?
Oh, well, you know, that's different kind of with every character and every, like, editorial group and all that. So speaking to this, the editorial group has provided everything that I could have wanted. You know, they've certainly given me plenty of things to read when I needed to read them, and they give me things to read that I didn't know I needed to read until they shared them with me. And I'm like, wow, I'm really glad I read this. In addition to that, you know, Scott Snyder has been super welcoming, you know, of me, and has made himself available to take a look at scripts. And, you know, recently he took a look at the first issue and gave me some of his thoughts. And they were incredible thoughts because he's Scott Snyder. So I can say with, you know, confidence and certainty that at least the Bat office over at DC is like a family. It really is. I mean, the Bat family extends from the page into the office itself. You know, Chris and David are editing. You know, Jamie Rich is overseeing the Bat office. And, you know, we're all like, you know, people that know each other and like each other and just want to see the best work done. So they've been incredibly generous, providing me with everything that I need, which is great because I'm also a student, you know, as well as a writer. So I like to study and make sure I'm doing things the proper way. I mean, I couldn't really ask for a better, you know, group of people to work with than the ones I've got right now. And the resource access has been amazing.
Yeah. And I would also say that you've, in a way, been researching for a long time, because you said yourself that Batman was really the character that you loved growing up and have been reading for years. So years of research behind.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I still know every line of dialogue from the 1989 film. You know, I was a kid that reread The Dark Knight Returns until it was dog-eared and faded in the bottom of a backpack. I've purchased Arkham Asylum 6 times, as I recall. You know, a couple times because there were special features and new editions, and many other times because I just forced it on my friends who didn't think that comics were literary, and I'm like, you have to read this, you know? So yeah, like I'm certainly fluent in a lot of aspects of the Bat mythos, but still, you know, you need to get the intel from what's going on at the moment, and you want to make sure that what you're doing is heading in the right direction.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And then also something that I think is really awesome that you're doing, you're tying a charity initiative into your Batman run. Is that, Brian, you want to tell our listeners about that?
Yes, and thank you for bringing it up. I certainly am. And there's... I'm pretty certain that my issue is going to be in like the back half of June rather than the first half of June. And that whole business is getting worked out this week. So I can't comment with certainty whether it's 982 or 983, but we will know which one that my issue starts with. However, once that's settled, I'm doing a small charity initiative. I'm going to set up a GoFundMe page. My wife has actually been helping me out with this because she's far more competent than I am at making things happen. And we're going to set up a GoFundMe page for the first 100 people that give a $5 donation to a Denver children's charity called Kid Street. You know, they work with kids who, you know, have medical needs and just providing them with some of the extra care that they need. If you make a $5 donation to Kid Street and you leave your address on the GoFundMe thing, and I'll have like a place for you to, you know, give me your address, I will personally mail you a signed copy of the first issue of my Detective Comics arc. And I'm going to do that for the first 100 people that donate $5. And then hopefully we will get through all of those 100 issues. And if we do, I'm going to personally match that with another $500. So we can, you know, get a check over there for about $1,000 for those kids.
That is,
and if
awesome.
if my schedule permits, I'm going to travel there myself. I don't know because I'm kind of busy, so I don't know if I'll be able to make it exactly. But if I can, then I'm going to go down there and meet with those kids personally. And if I can't do that, I'm going to make sure that there is a card that's sent to them with the name of everyone who donated, so all of those kids know that there are people out there they've never met that care about them and their futures. And in our own way, we're all trying to be like Batman.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And so listeners, when the details get ironed out and we're getting close to the time that the GoFundMe is about to start, I'll be sure and have all the details.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you follow me on Twitter at Brian Edward Hill, that's Brian with a Y, at Brian Edward Hill, I'm going to update it probably this week with all the details. And hopefully this will be a fun initiative that people will be happy to take part in, and I can continue to do things like this with more of the books that I write. You know, I mean, because when you're lucky enough to get these opportunities, I think it's very important that you give back, you know, in a way. And kids are just really important to me. I don't have any of my own. I'm just too busy to raise a child at the moment. But, you know, I just thinking about those kids who just need to know that people care. And need to know that, wow, you know, there are people out there that will do a little extra, you know, making sure that we have like a, you know, an extra couple toys or a couple more video games in our recreational room, whatever it is. I mean, that's kind of what Batman is all about. And it's my philosophy that if you write these superheroes, you need to somewhat manifest those ethics in your real life. You know, otherwise you're kind of betraying the legacy of the story you're telling. So, yeah, hopefully we can continue to do some things like this in the future. So follow me on Twitter, and details will be up very, very, very soon, and we can get that going.
Yeah, that's great. And listeners, there will be a link in the show notes, as usual, when I have a guest on with all their social media contacts. So you can just go and click there and click follow and get all the details. Now, speaking of Twitter, you did mention, I think yesterday or the day before, about one of my favorite properties. I mean, we're kind of an age that we grew up with this as a kind of a groundbreaking thing. There was some talk of Tron and perhaps the movie not being all it could have been. And you mentioned that you had some ideas. So I don't want you to completely spoil it in case it ever happens. But just
talk about
Tron.
Well, it's funny you bring that up because a lot of screenwriters yell at me on Twitter for giving away my ideas on social media. there was a couple of weeks ago, I was riffing on something, and like four or five like A-list screenwriters were in that thread like, stop talking, you shouldn't give this away for free. It was like Michael Green, Zach Stentz, Gary Whitta. It was hilarious, right? But yeah, the Tron thing, well, it started just, you know, someone had brought up like, you know, Tron as a missed opportunity, Tron Legacy is a missed opportunity, and I enjoy Tron Legacy. I think visually it's incredible. It's super impressive. I just thought that narratively it lost its way a little bit. You know, it starts off on a gladiator kind of dynamic, right? You know, you've got this Sam Flynn, he's going in to find his dad, he goes into the grid, and the grid is essentially a fascist kind of evil version of Rome, or an accurate version of Rome, depending on how you feel about Rome. But it leaves the kind of, you know, slave to hero, you know, to freedom fighter path that Gladiator takes, and it sort of gets lost, I think, a little bit in some of its own kind of rules and maze work as a narrative. But the great thing about it is, for me, you know, the idea that Sam and Cora were able to come into the real world. And we hear a lot about, like, well, can we Matrix again? Can the Matrix ever happen again? I don't really know. And I think there's a really interesting kind of way to explore what are Sam and Cora able to do in the real world? How does that affect the grid? How does the grid affect the real world? And is our real world someone else's grid, right? Which could be an interesting idea.
Yeah, big time.
Because the characters in the grid, you know, they're fairly convinced that they exist and they're sentient just like we are. And who's to say that our world isn't someone else's grid? And who's to say that, you know, existence might not be a series of like nesting grids, right? So you could have this kind of multidimensional sort of story for itself. So yeah, those are the kind of the ideas that I'm exploring. Like that would be the opening salvo of my conversation with Disney about Tron.
Yeah, here's that Disney. You got a giant franchise that can make you billions of dollars right here. You just need to tap into Brian's talent. Hope you're listening.
Well, you know, with a bunch of people, you know, who, you know, all around the world who all play video games, you know, with the rise of virtual reality, you know, it's in more homes now than it's ever been. I just think that there's something really magical and relevant there to explore. We just have to, you know, kind of dig into it, and something like Cyberforce, think about where we're headed and how a Tron story could match kind of our future, rather than trying to adhere it so closely to the past.
Right. I agree 100%. Yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you any longer, Brian. I know you have scripts to get to. So again, thanks for joining. Really appreciate the time. It's always great to chat with you.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. This is always one of the most relaxing podcasts I do. I appreciate you not throwing me a political curveball and trying to get me to say something that I don't want to say.
Yeah, you know I am not about that at all. So, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners? Hong Kong Fooey Lightning. I'll remind everybody, Brian did mention that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, like I said before, just look at the show notes and follow me on Twitter. I love talking to readers. I like getting feedback. And I also give writing tips and ideas and some career sort of perspective whenever I can. And some folks out there might find that useful. And look out for the Hong Kong Fooey Black Lightning crossover. Look out for Michael Cray, and go pick up this issue of Cyberforce. And I think you can still find number one in a couple places. Pick up one and two and tweet at me and tell me what you think.
Yeah, awesome. So at Brian Edward Hill on Twitter, is there any other social media that you want to mention, or is that the main spot?
Not really. That's sort of my main hub. I've been less and less active on Facebook, and I have an Instagram, but that's like the filmmaker photographer side of me.
Got it.
Which might be of little interest to comic fans.
Okay, well, thanks again for joining us. Don't forget, listeners, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. While you're there, be sure and check out all the other pop culture coverage on movies, TV shows, video games, all that kind of good stuff. And speaking of Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource is where we can be found on Twitter. Also, do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are great places to follow us and find out when new episodes are released and also keep track of all our convention coverage. So really want to thank Brian for joining.
Thank you guys for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time, everybody.